Blog Talk Radio. And welcome. I invite you to sit back and relax and enjoy the show, which tonight is rated M for mature audiences. Thank you for tuning in to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, the extended edition. If you're new to the show, I've been hosting it for 20 months and continue to do so because it seems to make such a difference to many of you out there. And I have to admit, I have great fun and get to talk to the most interesting men and women. As for those first 20 months of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, those interviews are not gone. I'd like to remind you they live indefinitely on my personal website at KarenTate.com because I've only been here at Blog Talk for a few months. And thank you so much for following me here and for your listener loyalty. You've just been listening to the sounds of Be Optimistic, and that snippet is from their song Maria, honoring an aspect of the Sacred Feminine. Apparently, she was their muse. Now, part of the reason Voices of the Sacred Feminine moved is to take your caller questions. So if you like, dial in and ask questions toward the end of the interview. And that number is 718-766-4662. When I see your call on the switchboard, I'll identify you by your area code and welcome you to have a chance to ask our guest a question. Again, that number is 718-766-4662. And if you can't listen live or don't want to be on the air, you can always email me some of your questions in advance. But keep tuning in each Wednesday night. And beginning next week, we move to 6 p.m. Pacific time as our permanent time slot. So don't miss us. In fact, you can join Blog Talk as a listener and have reminders sent to your email box of our shows so you won't forget about our awesome guests each week. And please, if you're a fan of the show, please indicate that by selecting us as a favorite on Blog Talk Radio. Well, tonight after my What's the Buzz segment, when I get to discuss what's happening out there in the world related to the divine feminine, whether we look at that as a deity, an archetype, or ideal, and also the lives of women across the globe, it'll be my great pleasure to bring you Angie Young, the filmmaker of The Coat Hanger Project, which was an official nominee of the 2009 Rosebud Film Festival. And in that documentary, Angie educates young women on what things were like for women before women had the rights to their own bodies and abortions were performed in back alleys, and we've heard about those proverbial and literal coat hangers. Pretty shocking, and maybe news to some young women who didn't live through those days. That's why we've had to mark the show for mature audiences, and also because of another interesting subject I want to bring to your attention, which I'm going to briefly touch on in the opening segment of What's the Buzz. The mature labeling was also due to the fact that I'm going to bring up the linguistic root of an offensive word that's been used in our times. If you have young children listening, you might want to be cautioned because we're talking about that C word. Now, we aren't going to say it. We've talked to Blog Talk about this, and I can discuss the subject, provided I don't actually say the word because it's so offensive. But it's a word that seems to need rehabilitation along with other words, most of which seem to be related to women. Well, I think a lot of us feel the word liberal certainly needs to be rehabilitated, but women's words in particular seem to have taken on negative connotations besides the C word, which we'll discuss in a moment. But some of these other words that really need a more positive spin these days are feminist, witch, priestess. I'm sure you can think of others. Well, getting on to the C word, here's what I've recently learned from a website that just loves and embraces the beloved vagina monologues of Eve Ensler. And this is about the origins of the C word. And this is what they say. Cuneiform, the most ancient form of writing, derives from the word kunta, K-U-N-T-A, meaning female genitalia in Sumerian of ancient Iraq. Kunta is woman in several Near Eastern and African languages and a mother tongue that is being compiled by linguists today. It was also spelled kuna, Q-U-N-A, which is the root of the word queen. Since priestesses were known to be accountants and administrators of temples of Inanna in Sumeria in 3100 BC, when cuneiform was first used, it is highly likely that cuneiform was, quote, the sign of the kunta, unquote, who kept the books or clay tablets for the temple economy and redistribution of wealth that evolved from communal economics of ancient mother cultures. So when an abuser calls a woman the C word, he is actually calling her a queen who invented writing and numerals. Pretty cool, huh? Girls and women can thus reclaim the word in our language that's been used as weapons against us in emotionally explosive situations. The word prostitute, which means lawgiver of the temple, and whore, which, and another word for whore is houri, H-O-U-R-I, which is in Persian means a gorgeous, semi-divine female that awaits men in the seventh heaven. And some of these are the finest compliments a woman can be given. Many ancient languages didn't have huge vocabularies as we do, and the same word had many meanings according to the context in which it was used. Going back to kunta, K-U-N-T-A, it also is the root of the word kundalini, which we know as energy, or khan, K-H-A-N, which means the highest leader of the Eurasian steppe nomads, whose society was originally matriarchal and who still have remnants of a matriarchy. Quantity is another one of these words. Any words that start with KW, QU, or KH. Examples are Kunda, C-U-N-D-A, which is the mother of Buddha, according to Japanese. Kunti Devi, the goddess of Kundalini energy. In India, Kunta means literally one who has female genitalia and describes a priestess. In ancient Sumerian, there's Kun, there's the goddess of mercy. In India, it goes on, and it's really very interesting. So the most interesting conclusion, you remember these words that start with Q-U, refers to like the Quran, Q-U-R-A-N, is actually the book of love for females. Female sensuality is probably the literal translation, but Muslims translate it as reading or lection, which is also flattering to females because the mothers of Arabs were always their only teachers before Muhammad dictated the Quran. Now, they have Quranic schools called madrasas, the mother schools, although they now teach only boys and we know denigrate women. Almost every value word in the Muslim religion, including the word Muslim, is a mother word derived from the mother root. And some of these others are Mohammed, Mufti, Mosque, Madrasa, Makkah, which is another word from Mecca, Madrina, Mujahideen, and many more. And finally, another variation is quern, Q-U-E-R-N, a handmill used by ancient women to grind grain and flour. The etymology points to housewives of ancient Mesopotamia, present-day Iraq, and parts of Iran, Palestine, and Syria, where agriculture began, as the ones who invented bread out of flour by adding a liquid and letting the dough sit for a while until airborne yeasts raised it. When baked in their clay ovens, it resulted in the most remarkable invention of the human race, the staff of life, or bread. It was also baked quickly without waiting for the yeast to lighten it. It's known today as pita bread. So I think that was an interesting topic when you consider our discussion tonight. And as long as we're on the subject of women's anatomy, I wanted to mention some awesome websites you might want to take a look at. Just Google Vulva Museum, and particularly look at an article on vaginas in mythology and history. And while you're there, check out the images in the Vulva Museum. They're beautiful. They're just gorgeous art. You won't want to miss it. And the next thing is a testament to how important gender archaeology and herstory actually are. I want to bring to your attention an article that just came out this week from the Daily Mail, a UK newspaper. The headline was, Ancient figurines were toys, not mother goddess statues. Well, you know, we've heard recently from the media these artifacts being described as pornographic, or it's the old ancient Barbie doll theory rearing its ugly head again. In the article, they were talking about the 9,000-year-old figurines dug up in Turkey being used as just educational toys. Yep, my hair was on fire, too. It all implies that all scientists are in agreement that these objects weren't sacred. Well, that's not the case. I don't have time here to go into these competing theories. I'll save that for another show. In fact, the upcoming Four Mothers and Wayshower series, Joan Marler, who's continuing the work of Maria Gimbutas, will be a guest, and maybe we can get into that a bit more. Until then, I invite you to visit the site of scholar Max Dashew, who I've had the honor of interviewing on the show several times, and I'm sure will return again. She's in the old archives on my website. You can find her there. Check out her webinars and her website at suppressedhistories.net. She also has these classes coming up and Woman's Power DVD. And then there's the archaeomythology website as well. Read what's there. Marguerite Rigoglioso, another scholar who's been on the show several times, has an article there, and she talks about Ian Hodder, the primary archaeologist at Çatalhöyük in Turkey, continuing to desacralize these objects despite the prior work of Maria Gimbutas and James Mellert. To quote Marguerite, "It has been a longstanding tradition of the Hodder team to erase the sacred female at Çatalhöyük. I certainly know from a tour I led there and from a woman I honor greatly, Lydia Rule, who goes there often, what a fight it was to get the scholars at Çatalhöyük to even acknowledge what an important pilgrimage site this is to goddess advocates today." Getting back to Max for a second, she also brings to our attention the work of other European and Asian archaeologists who apparently lean more toward these objects likely being sacred. And just like in Native American cultures, Kachina dolls were given to children to play with, and that didn't take away from their sacred meaning. And to end our What's the Buzz segment for tonight, I want to reach out and thank the former president, Jimmy Carter. If you've been listening to the news lately, you know in July he quit the Southern Baptist Church after being a member for decades because of their sexism. And just yesterday he spoke out about racism. So thank you so very much, former President Jimmy Carter. Where are the other voices of sanity and clarity? Just where are they? They just seem to be very lacking. So the bees are now released from my bonnet for another week, and I can turn our attention to tonight's guest, Angie Young. I thank her for being so patient. Let me tell you a little bit about Angie, and then the rest of the hour is going to be about her and her wonderful documentary, The Coat Hanger Project. Angie is a filmmaker and activist living in Washington, D.C. She served on the collective of Off Our Backs News Journal and has worked at the National Office of the National Abortion Federation as a hotline operator and a staff member. She currently works as a business manager and editorial assistant for the scholarly journal Feminist Studies out of College Park, Maryland. The Coat Hanger Project is her first documentary. Angie, thank you so much and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Karen, for having me on. It's such an honor to be part of this show. It's great. Thank you.
Well, you know, the work you're doing out there is awesome. You know, every time the issue even raises its head of Roe v. Wade going down the drain, I just think, you know, have we all lost our mind? You know, how short are people's memories? And, you know, your documentary really does address that. Why don't you tell me a little bit about your background, how you're a pro-choice feminist and you're an activist. How did that all come about, and what was your motivation to become a filmmaker?
Absolutely. Well, I can definitely speak to that a little bit. I didn't start out in this making documentaries or as a filmmaker. I came to Washington, D.C. after college with an urge to really try to change the world and make it be better. I studied women's studies in college, and I kind of found feminism in college, and it was an internship at Off Our Backs Feminist News Journal that brought me to Washington, D.C. for the first time, and I sort of became acquainted with some of the issues of feminism. And I think definitely my my experience with OfferBacks, because after the internship, I did end up moving here. And I started off at the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association. That was my first nonprofit job in Washington. And then I went from there to working in the pro-choice movement as I was really starting to feel like I wanted to bring my feminist activism into the foreground of my career. So I got a job working at the National Abortion Federation's hotline, and that job probably was one of the most life-changing jobs I've ever had. I got to work under a legendary teacher, Rachel Falls, who she passed away in 2008, but she was the head of the National Abortion Federation hotline and did an amazing job, and it still is amazing. But I was really, really lucky to get a chance to work under her and be trained by her in learning how to talk to women about this issue, learning how to talk to women in crisis situations, and understanding what the experience of having an unwanted pregnancy really sort of felt like, to be able to give women sort of tools of how to figure out what the best option is going to be for them, and if they do decide that abortion is going to be that option, to help them have the resources that they need to get that, the phone number, and if they don't have a lot of money, funding options, although the funding options are getting lesser and lesser in these tough economic times. So I would say working on the hotline was an incredible experience and really opened my eyes to the realities of abortion right now in our society and how hard it is for some women. 87% of counties don't have an abortion provider. There are economic barriers. There are all different kinds of barriers. There are social barriers. There are the issue of stigma, the issue of feeling guilty and not knowing what to do, the issue of low self-esteem, the issue of violence in relationships, all of these issues sort of are, you know, all connected. And learning how to talk about that was an amazing thing that happened while I was working there at NAF. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, that's okay. If you could see me, I'm sitting here shaking my head because I can just imagine, you know, all of these issues and challenges that women face that feminism wants to try to address to make this a fairer culture, a more caring culture. You see them all sort of intersect, I bet, on that hotline. You know, when you mention some of them, you know, domestic violence, you know, religious stigma, you know, all of these, economic issues, you know, all of the things that are problems for women today because of the inequality in our culture, I think. It all sort of lays at the foot of this issue as well. Are you finding over the years that you've been doing this that that the stigma of abortion is getting less or getting to be more? I mean, are the evangelicals and pro-lifers winning this battle, or what's your sense of it?
That's a really interesting thing to think about. I would say that while I was working on the hotline and when I was in direct touch with women who are going through this, some of them were definitely pro-choice, but some of them were definitely not pro-choice, and they still were needing to have access to abortion. And there just is a whole spectrum of feelings that go along with the experience today. I think that the right, or the religious right, with their signs and their organizing and the money that they have coming in from the big churches in order to enable this organizing at this level and the proliferation of signs and the proliferation of people, it has had an impact. And it has, in fact, shifted the entire argument about abortion into an area where people who are pro-choice even are on the defense. I mean, I think that this is what's happened since the 1970s. I did, just to digress just a little bit. I did a media project at the National Abortion Federation conference with Melissa Silverstein, who does the Women in Hollywood blog, who is amazing. And we put together clips of TV shows depicting abortion starting from Maud in 1973, which I think was the first time that it was aired on a cable news station, and moving through with Degrassi High, Dirty Dancing, different kinds of things in TVs and in movies, up to the present day, different types of television shows. And it was uncanny to see the voice that Maud was speaking, or actually it was more her daughter in the episode of Maud where she is dealing with having an abortion, but the feminist voice in that was the strongest, definitely, of any of the shows. And there definitely was a de-escalation of a feminist voice when talking about abortion. And I think that we have a lot of ground to pick up, and I think that we have lost a lot of ground.
Do you think it's because we've gotten complacent? We thought the battle was won and we don't have to think about it anymore. And it's just something that's been sort of taken for granted by a lot of people, and maybe even young women, no offense against young women, but some of them are they don't want to be associated with the word feminist, which makes me think maybe they're not totally aware or have maybe the proper outlook on what, women suffered to get these rights that we have today. Maybe they just need sort of a re-education about how hard this fight was. And I don't know. I feel like I'm rambling. Did that question make any sense?
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that hits on the point that I really am sort of get to the heart of what I'm trying to do with the Coat Hanger Project. One of the things that I discovered in the process of making the Coat Hanger Project in talking to young women, especially college age women, that are in 18, 19, 20, 21, a lot of them, surprisingly, a surprising amount of these young women did not know, and young men, did not know the significance of the coat hanger. And I think that it does have to do with the fact that we're the first generation. Roe was passed in 1973, and all of us here, and myself included, I'm a post-1973 baby, we have lived our whole lives with legalized abortion and have no direct memory in our lifetimes of having what women went through before abortion was legal. We did not lose a mother. We did not lose a sister. We did not lose an aunt or a best friend. These are memories of a generation, before us, and it doesn't translate, I think, in just talking about it and just anecdotes. And then there's also the fact that nobody talks about it. There really is kind of a vacuum. The abortion theme line in a lot of TV shows, it isn't even there, or conveniently in a plot line, the woman will have a miscarriage or whatever, but the actual choice of having an abortion just is very rare, even in our pop culture discourse.
I think the religious right has gotten so loud and so belligerent and so crazy, to the point of people being killed, and we're going to talk about Dr. Tiller and his legacy. It's really a shame that this sort of crazy behavior can stifle such important things that need to be discussed. Look at what's happening in healthcare. There's no debate. There's just yelling and screaming and lies and finger pointing and making people crazy. And it's those very same people in a lot of cases that are, making it uncomfortable and awkward to talk about abortion. And as a goddess advocate, I am a firm believer, and every goddess advocate probably will not agree with me, but I am a firm believer, you never take away a woman's rights. I don't care, about the rest. It is her decision, and nobody should tell a woman what to do with her body, period. It's just that simple. I'm sorry. What she chooses to do, she will live with, and if there are any consequences or karma or whatever, that will be hers. But I just don't think you can can take those rights away from a woman, because then, you know, it's almost like she is a slave to her body. You know, I don't know. Am I being drastic?
I completely agree with you. I mean, obviously, so I am definitely with you. But I think also a thing to think about is how easy it is for a woman's authentic experience to be erased in this culture. And for the struggle that she has to go through in the decision making that goes along with something like abortion. I feel like it's easy to ignore that in this society, or not that it's easy, but that there just is a tendency to do that, and for these other ideas to just become overshadowing, to overshadow what a woman's experience is, like this idea that you're supposed to just feel so guilty, or the idea that, you know, this is such a bad thing to do that it's better to do something that you're not prepared to do, to be basically a slave in your own body, that right. is what is supposed to happen. And I feel like it has to do with patriarchy. I feel like it has to do with the fact that we've lost our analysis of our own liberation, that's a part of feminism that has just been lost on this generation a little bit right now, because our oppression is happening in all of these new ways, but we're complacent with it. I mean, pop culture is complacent with it, and there's nobody like raising these questions, or there's not enough people raising these
right.
questions, you know? And
right.
I feel like,
well, you know,
yeah.
Women suffer so many different ways. You know, I've said here on the show, you know, women don't just suffer or hurt from a clenched fist. You know, we suffer so many ways by not being fully represented in academia, in corporate management, in you know, religious, you know, in higher authority, basically. You know, that we have domestic violence, which is swept under the rug. We have, you know, religions that even tell women that, you know, if your husband abandons you or abuses you. I'm trying to remember how it goes. I think it's abandonment or adultery. Those are grounds for divorce, but not abuse. I mean, there's so much programming and propaganda goes into women's oppression of so many different kinds. And when you talk about this to some people, they think, well, you're an angry feminist. And you know what? It's not about being an angry feminist. It's about talking about the facts and saying, hey, is this fair? Is this the way it should be? You know, it's really just as simple as that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hard. Our society right now, I mean, it's complicated. Yeah, there has been, words that have come up to discredit us. I mean, Rush Limbaugh, you know, for coming up with feminazi. You know, I mean, don't even get me started. But there really is closing off of your hearing, I think, for a lot of people who don't want to be associated with what the name or the idea of feminism has become, because the lens of pop culture and being distorted into this, you know, ugly stereotype of a monster, basically, where what the goals of feminism are, you know, about liberation and about everything that is good. So
equality, justice, you know, all of those. Well, getting back to the coat hanger project, was there anything in particular that was sort of the catalyst for it? I don't know if it's, you know, too personal a question, but did something happen to a friend of yours, or was it just what you were hearing and experiencing on that hotline that made you say, you know what, we need something to show people and educate?
Mm-hmm. It was sort of a convergence of a couple of things. When I worked on the hotline at NAF, and then I actually went on to work for the staff of the national organization, and during that time, in around 2006, South Dakota was facing the most hardcore abortion ban pretty much ever. I mean, there was no exceptions, and there was a huge mobilization of pro-choice volunteers to go down to South Dakota to work on overturning the ban. I mean, all of the national organizations were sending down volunteers, and I was lucky enough to get a chance to go. And I sort of recognized that this was a really unique opportunity and a unique moment in the history of the struggle, and I wanted to document it in some way. And so I bought a little camera, and I brought it with me. I didn't realize it then, but that became the beginning of the coat hanger project, and it became one element of what I examine in my documentary. But another thing that happened also was I was experiencing a lot of anger because in my liberal Washington, D.C., I would walk through DuPont Circle every day to go to the old NAF office, and some anti-choice protesters decided that they were going to have a demonstration in my liberal, beautiful D.C. Starting every Friday, and I had to walk through it, and I had to look at it. And what made me mad is that there was nobody showing the other side, and there was nobody showing that actually pro-life means pro-death, and it's pro the death of women and pro the death of liberty and pro the death of our souls if we can't decide this for ourselves. And nobody was holding up those signs, and I was thinking, you know, okay, I can stage a protest, I can try to do this, but I knew how much it would require and how not mighty enough to combat all of the funding and thousands of volunteers and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so I thought, what could I do? What could I do that could be like holding up signs that could combat that? And then I realized that actually maybe through media, through creating something that could be shown and that can be like reproduced virally on the internet, it could be like me holding up a sign. And that was also part of the media installation component of what I wanted to do with the Coat Hanger Project, to create a teaching tool, something that could be like me holding up a sign and saying, no, actually that's not the whole story. You're forgetting a big part of it.
Uh-huh. Well, let me ask you a question, and this is kind of a difficult question because I really do believe in women supporting women, but, you know, I think you have to sort of shine the light on things to, disinfect them, to know the truth, that sort of metaphor. You know, we're seeing what's going on in the news right now, that a lot of these people screaming and shouting really aren't very well informed, in some cases maybe even aren't very well educated. Is that part of this too? I mean, are there any statistics out there that say, about the education levels of, you know, or the awareness levels of the pro-choice versus the pro-life? I mean, does something like that actually even exist, or is it more religious as opposed to, educationally driven choices?
That's a good question, and I'm not aware of statistics that I could draw up right now that would speak to that, but I think just on a
on an
anecdotal level, I feel like with education comes awareness and comes empathy and comes a heightened understanding of the experiences of people that are not like you necessarily, or of your own experiences. And I think that education does help people to be made more aware, you know, of what other people are like, and that really, you know, we are all equal. I believe that education can do that. And when you do not have access to these thoughts and these ideas and these thinkers that can help you grow intellectually, that it becomes easier to buy into propaganda and to buy into the dominant paradigm when you don't know, when there isn't these other things that you can have access to. Also,
yeah, you just don't hear the other side. I mean, I grew up in the South. I mean, fortunately, I got out and I moved to California and my whole world opened up. But I know what it's like to live in a bubble where, you know, you only meet the very same people with the very same ideas. And, that can be a scary thing. And you don't even realize how sheltered you are and what a bubble you're living in.
Absolutely. And also religions, I mean, tend to be either, I mean, there are lots of different kinds of interpretations of religion, and it's not all this way. I think there are new ways of interpreting religion that aren't necessarily this way, but a lot of religion comes from, it's the ideas of our ancient folks, and it's of these patriarchal concepts and of men who wanted to write down, you know, the way that they thought it was or the way that they perceived it was. And I mean, it is what it is. And it...
Well, Well, you know, in going back to what you said about those, you know, those energetic, passionate, you know, pro-lifers out there in your park when you had to go to work every day, I have a theory, and I don't know whether, you know, again, this is just anecdotal, but sometimes I've wondered why the liberals don't seem to fight as hard as the conservatives. And I don't know, the only thing I've come to is that we just have this live and let live kind of attitude. You know, we don't get crazy and all worked up over things quite so much. And
no,
I don't know if
I think it's also that liberals are happier because when you have rights and you believe in equality and you believe in, you know, the kinds of things of like of love and acceptance and these ideas, I think that you actually have a higher quality of life. You have a happier quality of life because you can see this like connectedness in all of us, and you want to have hope, and you want to really like make things be good. This is just my theory. I don't have proof for this,
yeah.
But I feel like yeah. when you are getting to live that, that's pretty good, and it is.
You don't have these power and control issues of the patriarchy.
Yeah, yeah. When you're sort of deconstructing that, then I think that, well, I guess the downside of being happy is lack of motivation to, you know, mobilize and change. And,
yeah.
you know, these ideas of revolution, I think, usually come out of unrest and of people being really unhappy and perceiving injustice. And I think that's part of why, you know, the younger generation of young women, of feminists, of young men and women has not necessarily like picked up the mantle on this. But what's going to happen if we don't become, you know, if we don't continue to have an interest in maintaining these rights, is that we will lose them, and then we will have to learn the hard way yet again why we fought for these rights in the first place. And that's what I'm trying to help prevent from happening through education and through putting these ideas out there.
Well, I can't wait to see this film. I can't wait till you get here in Los Angeles, and I'm going to, you know, introduce you to whoever I know who might be able to help get you some sort of a showing here. I would imagine you must have run into a lot of difficulty to film this. Do you want to talk a little bit about how it was received and the challenges along the way?
Yeah, you know, it is. It has been a crazy experience as far as that goes, in a lot, in good ways. But the challenges I felt that I really had happen were not as many as I would have thought might have happened. I was not, you know, I never really encountered a situation where I was afraid for my own life or anything, you know, crazy dramatic like that. What I did get a chance to do was meet and kind of speak with anti-choice protesters and sort of get a little bit of a sense of how they operate and what they are about, which was definitely an educational experience for me. But one thing that did happen that was kind of sad is that I had a MySpace page that actually was a way that I was able to connect with. There's a woman in the military that I interview who was serving time in Iraq, and there are no abortions in military hospitals. And she almost died trying to give herself an abortion. But she, with her story, she was able to connect with me through MySpace. And at one point, I had, you know, I had over 1,000 friends. And then just one day, my MySpace profile was deleted unexpectedly. And everything that I had saved on it, everything was gone. All my friends were gone. And, you know, I can
how
only
long
imagine.
Ago did that, how long ago did that happen?
I think it happened back in... I think it was in 2007.
Well, you know, let's talk about this after the show. I actually had a friend that something like that happened to. She actually went to the MySpace people, and she actually got her site retrieved. I just wonder if that might be possible for you.
Oh,
that
that's
great.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. I made a new MySpace site. That would be cool. Well, let's definitely talk about that. But I would say that was really, I mean, and I'm so lucky, I'm knocking on wood, that's been pretty much the most negative thing that I've experienced while making this.
And you met Dr. Tiller as well? Maybe
I did. That was another reason that I wanted to make the Coathanger Project, because I had access to some of the most famous and well-known abortion providers in the country through my work at the National Abortion Federation. I mean, I was able to meet Dr. Mildred Hansen, who is a pre-Roe abortion provider out of Minnesota. She's amazing. She became known for helping introduce the technique of laminaria insertion in second trimester procedures, and she is a rock star. And I also met Dr. Tiller and had actually, in fact, asked him to be a part of the Coat Hanger Project, and it was back when he was dealing with the Kansas City lawsuits, or the lawsuits in the state of Kansas, which he was acquitted of all of the charges that he had been charged with, but we never got a chance to do the interview. He was an amazing man and an inspiration for so many. I think everybody who met him felt that way. He just was kind of like a rock star.
I'm wondering if anything in the documentary addresses the fact, some of the issues that came out during Dr. Tiller's death, that the, law enforcement, even the FBI, they're really doing very little to protect the abortion providers. Is that something you ran into very much?
Well, I did get in some of my interviews with the abortion providers, we did talk about that, and it ended up not being something that I was able to spend as much time with as I would have liked in the Coat Hanger Project. But in one of my interviews with a retired abortion provider in Canada, she was working during the time of when there was, I'm totally spacing on his name right now, but a Canadian abortion provider that got killed, and the degree to which she had to deal with safety precautions was overwhelming. And Dr. Tiller had a bodyguard. You have to have a lot of protection, and even that, as the evidence shows, isn't necessarily enough to keep you safe.
I know Dr. Tiller, I believe, was killed in his church. Was his bodyguard there with him?
I don't know the answer to that, but I know that church was pretty much the only place he went without a bulletproof vest. I mean, I guess he got shot in the head, so it wouldn't have mattered. But
it's
a pretty low
blow
to go into the church. Pretty bad.
Well, now, how widely have you been able to spread this, showing the Coat Hanger Project? I know you're getting ready to go to Ireland and Poland, and we want to talk about that, but are you having a lot of luck on a lot of college campuses across the country?
I've been lucky enough to show it at a few different college campuses across the country and in Canada. I'm still, I'm trying to set up as many screenings as possible. I'm doing it around, I have a full-time job in Washington, D.C., and it was sort of like around that, wherever I can. I'm trying to get as many speaking engagements, and yes, I am about to show the Coat Hanger Project in several different cities in Ireland and also the U.K. and Poland. And I'm going to be working with Sarah Diehl, who is a German filmmaker who made Abortion, Democracy, Poland, South Africa. And when I released the Coat Hanger Project in 2008, she was also releasing her documentary, and she and I also connected through the internet, but we ended up releasing our films together, and we went on a screening tour in the U.S. and Canada back in 2008. So we're going to do that again, but in Ireland, where abortion is illegal, and also in Poland, where abortion is illegal. And we're just going to take 2 weeks to kind of do as much activism and just screenings and having question and answer sessions as we can in that time.
So are you finding that, groups or the church are trying to keep you out or anything like that of Poland and Ireland?
So far, there, knock on wood again, there hasn't been anything like that I have found. I don't know what I'm going to be in for when I go there. I'm hoping it's going to be okay. But it's like a step up in the intensity level for me just to be doing this in a place where it really is sort of transgressive in terms of the law. We have freedom of speech in the U.S., but things are going to be,
Good for you. I mean, I interview a lot of women, and I started to think about this woman I had on my show, Sandra Pope, who was talking about abuse as a child and domestic violence. And, you know, when we speak about these things, I think we give others permission to think different thoughts and speak their truth and speak their experiences. And, it's important to be done. You know, it's just the power of the word. So I thank you for everything you're doing, because I hear you. I have a full-time job that pays the bills, all this other radio show stuff, book stuff, speaking gigs. That's all, you know, my passion too, that, you know, has to be done on the weekends and doesn't usually finance itself, you know, but if you think it's important, if you want to make a difference in the world, well, you know, we just do it anyway. And I'm glad you're out there with this.
Oh, likewise. I love your radio show. I'm so happy that I got to be a part of it. It's very, very awesome.
Well, listen, let me ask you a little bit more. Now, tell me what a DIY media activist is.
Well, basically what that means to me is, you know, somebody who just picks up a camera, records, and, you know, puts something together and puts it out there. I would say the Coat Hanger Project, having had no real education in how to make a documentary, I really sort of consider it a DIY documentary. I learned so much in the process.
Oh, do it yourself. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, my God, my husband's watching DIY all the time. It just didn't click. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I really feel like it's important to recognize that we are in a very special time, because we are in a time when camera technology and filming technology has gotten cheaper and easier than ever before. And what used to be a process that involved, you know, a light meter and shooting on film and developing film, and it was expensive, and putting it together by hand, is now something that has just gotten, it's very easy to do. I love analog, I love film, not to say that I don't appreciate the beautifulness of the craft of filmmaking, and I'm trying to learn more about that myself. But in terms of this other way, in terms of activism, in terms of making our voices heard as liberal people, as people who want to change the world and make it be better and are sick of the status quo and really think that we could be living in a better world, we could make this better world here, like we need to be doing work, you know, we need to be picking up cameras, like, and not just about abortion, about the environment, about, you know, the rights of people, about our economic crisis, about everything that is going on, you know, we need to step up and do it. There's no difference between me and any other person. We can all do that, and it's a very special time that we're living in, so we've got to take advantage of it and use it for good.
Well, no, I totally agree, and I'm starting to wonder how long it's going to be before the internet is somehow controlled or put at such a cost if, you know, we no longer have the accessibility to one another that we have. But that makes me wonder: do you have any trailers about this on YouTube? Since YouTube is such a huge thing these days, that might be another way to, you know, to sort of put teasers out there.
Absolutely. Yes, and I do have my trailer on YouTube. I don't have the whole film on YouTube, but I do have a trailer, and I also have some clips from I've videotaped pro-choice counter protest. In addition to the anti-choice folks who are holding up the fetus signs, I documented the work of some feminist activists who are trying to combat those messages by doing their own pro-choice activism. And I have some videos like that up on my YouTube site, but it's under the Coat Hanger Project, and you can go there and visit it anytime you want
Okay, so you could just put it in the search box at YouTube, the Coat Hanger Project.
Yeah, youtube.com/the Coat Hanger Project, and that is where I am putting stuff and other little videos that I am sort of in the process of making, and I will be putting more stuff up there as I go. I'm working on two other documentaries right now, and I will be, sort of updating those as well as I go with that.
Well, let me give your website, and then I want to talk to you a little bit because we have a little bit more time. We can briefly get into those other film projects. But for anyone who's listening that wants to find you besides on YouTube, your website is the same as your documentary name, thecoathangerproject.com. Thecoathangerproject.com. All right, so now I know your two new documentary projects are Do We Really Need the HPV Vaccine and the Incest Machine? Do you want to take a minute or two and talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, definitely. I'm really excited about both of them. The first documentary I am co-producing with an amazing, awesome artist and activist, Julie Slater from Denver, Colorado, who I actually met by screening the Coat Hanger Project in Denver with her back in 2008. But anyways, we are working together to create this documentary that is about the HPV vaccine, Gardasil. And it's about the vaccine, but it's also about the controversies surrounding implementation of the vaccine. There are two statewide mandates right now that are in effect for sixth grade girls going into the sixth grade, having to get this vaccination that is still, it's a very new and they're still kind of figuring out the kinks of it. But there are, you know, arguments on both sides of it. You know, people don't want their kids to be test subjects, you know, on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's, you know, cervical cancer is a disease that does kill some people, so to have a vaccine to prevent it, how can that be anything but a good thing? But it's a little bit, I don't know, it gets a little bit tricky in terms of the implementation of this vaccine. So the documentary is about that, and it's hopefully it will be done in 2010. We're still sort of putting it together. So that's a little bit about that documentary. And I'm also working on a documentary that is called The Incest Machine, and it is about incest, and it is about an analysis of incest, kind of on a structural level, a theoretical level, a personal level, and I'm in the interview process right now, but I'm talking with survivors, and I'm also going to be talking with people who specialize in healing, helping heal people who've been through this experience. And also incest as it appears as a subject in our culture, in art, in literature, in all of its different forms, how it's understood. So it's going to kind of be a project that that sort of takes a look at this very, you know, very difficult kind of taboo subject.
Oh, yeah, I was just about to say that's still a real taboo subject. Angie, I tell you, you are doing great work. You are a way shower. You are courageous. You are part of the future. You know, you are some of the young women that we are going to pass the torch to keep making this world a better place for women. So I just thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing more of your work, and especially if you get out here to Los Angeles. I can't wait to meet you and shake your hand and just sit there with a box of popcorn and watch this wonderful documentary. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Karen.
And just one last time, we're talking to Angie Young with the Coat Hanger Project, and if you can go on YouTube and see some trailers or go to her website, the Coat Hanger Project. Now, Angie, you're welcome to stick around. I'm just going to do some announcements and play some music and do some other things to close the show. You're welcome to stay with us, or if you have other things to do, I know you're on the East Coast. It's getting late there. It's up to you if you have to depart now or if you'd like to stay with me, so I'll leave that to you. But thank you so very much. And I guess, though, you know, is there anything I didn't ask you? I mean, is there any one particular thought you might like to leave listeners with, you know, something important that we forgot to say in our discussion?
I don't think so. I think we touched on a lot. The only thing that I just put out there as a current events just issue regarding abortion and healthcare reform, just to set it clear, I just did some research about it because I didn't know, but the Hyde Amendment is still in effect with abortion coverage in terms of federal funds going to it. In other words, no federal funds would be going to abortion under the new health care reform, with the exception of rape, incest, or the health of the woman. So just to throw that out there, because there's just a lot of hype and mixed messages about that, this healthcare reform does not include this funding for abortion care except for these few exceptions. So just to throw that out there, just to think about, you okay with that? I'm not really okay with that. Some things to think about.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Angie. Thank you very much. And, just good luck with it. I hope, this is something that is shown across the globe. Every woman needs to see this. And, I hope it empowers them to stand up and say, you know what, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yes.
Okay, well, listeners, I'm going to take a little break now and for just about a minute, and I'm going to let you listen to Jenna Green's song called Believe, and I'll be right back with some important announcements.
Keep your wonder and wild heart, and from the fairy you'll never part.
Well, I hope you're still with us, and I want to get to my announcements now. If you're just tuning back in or you had to step away, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where every week we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, and ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might make the world a better place. Some new news for you. I'm happy to report I am having great fun. I am now the Los Angeles Women's and Goddess Spirituality Examiner on examiner.com. So check out my articles. You can find them by going to examiner.com, or very soon I'll have a link to my examiner articles on my website. My first two articles have been about what is goddess spirituality, who are goddess advocates, and the strange bedfellows, the threesome, history, herstory, and truth make. And just last night I posted an article about Jimmy Carter, that goddess advocates applaud his work and how he's speaking out against sexism and racism. Coming in the fall here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, you won't want to miss our Four Mothers and Way Shower series. We have lots of women and men scheduled that certainly fit the profile. I was inspired to do this series by your emails asking where are the Four Mothers, and they've heard you and they've all agreed to gather here on Wednesday nights at 6 p.m. Pacific. And don't forget, you can email your questions or you can call in during that series. Keep tuning in and hear the voices of these leaders who paved the way for goddess advocates everywhere. You won't be disappointed with the incredible lineup of guests. Here's just a few names I'll put out there. Pat Monahan, Jean Shinoda Bolen, Judy Grand, Carol Crist, Eleanor Gadden, Isaac Bonowitz, Rianne Eisler, Starhawk, and those are just a few. Also, coming in January, I'm going to be teaching a well-known and beloved class at the Goddess Temple in Orange County in the city of Irvine. It's a 11-session class. It's Cakes for the Queen of Heaven. It's a seminar series in feminist theology. It explores women's power, past, present, and future in the context of our religious history, including subjects of domination and subordination, suppression of the female presence in Judaism and Christianity, women's access to power, how patriarchal religious philosophy affected relationships among women, men, families, and society's institutional power structures. The classes are $25 each. They're on Saturday afternoons. Classes are about 4 hours. If you would like to register, because we are already registering people, you can go to my website, KarenTate.com, and you can register by sending a check or using PayPal. Let's see. Also, very important, if you know military, retired or active, military personnel or their families in Southern California, please let them know about the upcoming Kuan Yin ceremony being organized in their honor and held again at the Goddess Temple of Orange County on Saturday, September 26th. That's just next Saturday. It's right around the corner. So please come. Please share the word. The ritual is called to honor and heal those who serve. No matter how you feel about war and politics, it is these people who sacrifice for so many of us, and it's their night to be honored, receive healing, and be appreciated by the community. There will be performances by talented artists who have agreed to come and entertain. Many individuals and businesses have made just generous donations to a silent auction, and items are going to be auctioned off at pennies on the dollar, so the military and their families might be able to take advantage of wonderful vacation getaways, services, art, jewelry, and spiritual items, just nice things to uplift their spirits as a way to say thank you. If you'd like more information about any of this, again, you can reach me at KarenTate.com, or my email address is KarenTate108@ca.rr.com. Next week, the show starts at 6 p.m. Pacific. I want to remind you again, and our guest is Julia Hughes Jones. We're going to be discussing her new book called What Women Need to Know About Their History. It's an awesome book. I met Julia when she tantalized me with a quote from Martin Luther, who said, "Girls grow faster than boys because weeds grow faster than good crops," which was certainly a testament to his belief in women's inferiority. So you just tune in, and we're going to have a wonderful discussion about that next week. And our last show of the month will be an interview with Nikki Scully discussing becoming an oracle, connecting with the divine source for healing and information. Don't forget my new Sunday morning radio show, Earth Sacred Places, on the CBS affiliate, psychiconair.com. The show airs at 8 a.m. Eastern and 5 a.m. Pacific, pretty early in the morning if you're on the West Coast, eh? So grab a cup of coffee with me before we board what I like to call the Armchair Express. I know it's cheesy, but it's fun, to sacred places around the globe. And if you're a late riser, just catch the show from the archives at your convenience. It's usually posted on Monday. We've had wonderful guests talking about sacred display objects and Sheila Nagigs that we find in sacred places, Black Madonnas, sacred places in Hawaii, Sardinia, Malta, Australia, India, Artemis of Ephesus, Aradia. I mean, just go take a look. We're building quite an archive there on the CBS affiliate, as well as the one that lives on my website. Again, speaking of my website, if you don't know, I have free downloadable meditations there. While you're there, check out my book, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. It's garnered prestigious endorsements, and Walking an Ancient Path was even a finalist in the USA National Best Books of 2008 Awards. The scholar David Hillman remarked that the book Walking an Ancient Path was not only immensely pleasurable in an enlightening journey, but it stands boldly against the patriarchal denigration of the divine feminine. Well, I guess, listeners, as the show comes to a close for tonight, if you like what you've been hearing on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, please tell your friends to tune in, and please add us to one of your blog talk favorites. Even consider signing up as a listener and have reminders of upcoming shows sent directly to your email box. I'd like to leave you tonight with one of the musical pieces of one of the generous artists who have agreed to let me use their music on the show. So let's see, who are we going to pick tonight? I think we'll go with Looking for a regular full-length song here for you. Let's go with one of my favorites. This is called Sekhmet from the group called Zingaya and Caitlin Breen. So this will last about 5 minutes, and that will be the end of the show, listeners. So thank you so much for being with us tonight. I hope you enjoyed my wonderful guest, Angie Young, the documentarian of the Coat Hanger Project. And please tune in again next week. I promise it'll be another good show. Good night.
Sekhmet, the desert, heart, fire.